Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton has called the timing of the FBI's announcement that it is assessing new evidence in her case unprecedented and deeply troubling. Clinton spoke Saturday at a campaign appearance in Daytona, Florida.
So no matter what they throw at us in these last days, we're not going to back down. We're not going to get distracted. We're not going to get knocked off course. Because we know how much this election matters.
FBI Director James Comey said in a letter to lawmakers Friday that new emails have surfaced that are related to Clinton's case, despite an FBI tradition of avoiding controversial actions in the days leading up to an election. Republican U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump on Saturday called this latest wrinkle the lowest point in the history of our country.
Public corruption is a grave and profound threat to a democracy. Government corruption spreads outward like a cancer and infects the operations of government itself.
Trump spoke at a campaign event in the swing state of Colorado. Central Italy has been rocked by another strong earthquake, the latest since a deadly quake on August 24th. Italy's Civil Protection Authority says the powerful 6.6 magnitude quake early Sunday brought down buildings in numerous places across the area. Authorities said some 20 people sustained light injuries. That there were no reports of deaths was largely due because thousands of residents left their homes after two strong jolts last week. VOA News. A U.S. government monitoring agency says Afghanistan's security forces battling the resurgent Taliban have suffered around 15,000 casualties, including 5,523 fatalities in the first 8 months of 2016. The agency is also warned of eroding gains the war-shattered country has made with the help of the international community. The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, in its quarterly report published Sunday, noted the Afghan government lost 2.2% territorial control during this year's fighting. The European Union and Canada signed a long-delayed landmark free trade agreement Sunday in Brussels aimed to boost growth and jobs. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau signed the comprehensive and economic trade agreement along with the heads of EU institutions. Trudeau spoke about the agreement.
Greater market access, more economic growth, and stronger job creation. That's good news for Canada's middle class and for the communities they call home.
The signing ceremony had been pushed back from Thursday after French-speaking Wallonia, with just 3.6 million people, initially vetoed an agreement affecting more than 500 million Europeans and 35 million Canadians. The EU requires unanimity among its 28 members, and Belgium needed the backing of all its regions to approve the agreement. Turkey has dismissed more than 10,000 civil servants as the government continues its crackdown following a failed coup in July. News of the removal of the academics, teachers, and health workers was published late Saturday. Turkey has already ousted more than 80,000 civil servants and arrested more than 30,000 in connection with the coup. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has repeatedly accused cleric Fethullah Gulen of being behind the coup attempt that left at least 270 people dead. South Korea's president, who's in the middle of an influence-peddling scandal, accepted the resignation of several of her top aides Sunday. A presidential spokesman said Park Geun-hye accepted the resignations of her chief of staff and the senior secretaries for policy coordination, political affairs, civil affairs, and public relations. Also Sunday, the woman who's at the center of the president's political scandal returned to Seoul from Germany. Choi Soon-sil's lawyer said Choi will actively respond to prosecutors' investigation and will testify according to the facts. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
For us in the UPND opposition, we think that it is part of the scheme of the ruling party to take this country to a one-party state.
A leading Zambia ruling party member wants the presidential term to be increased from 5 to 7 years.
He says the Boko Haram of today is no longer the Boko Haram of 2014. When it could attack on a large scale.
Chadian President Idriss Deby says the multinational joint task force fighting Boko Haram faces challenges.
I'm taking these children so that they can get good education because I do not see any good studies for children with all this chaos.
And thousands of South Sudanese Imatong State residents flee to Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Leading member of the Zambian ruling Patriotic Front Party, or PF, has called for a constitutional amendment to extend presidential term limit from 5 to 7 years. Paul Munga from the ruling party's Central Committee also proposes an increase in the tenure for members of parliament and civic leaders. But Charles Kakoma, spokesman for the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, told me the proposal is regrettable and unfortunate.
That proposal is outrageous, but for us in the UPND opposition, we think that it is part of the scheme of the ruling party to take this country to a one-party state, and that is just one step into that direction. They are testing the waters, testing public opinion, and if they see that the public is quiet or docile, we'll go ahead and amend the constitution to insert the 7-year term of office. But sooner rather than later, there will be another person proposing that the country returns to a one-party state, because that is what the ruling party's Secretary General told us last year, that this country is better off as a one-party state than a multi-party. So it officially already came out of the mouth of the Secretary General with the ruling party.
But Charles, some people are expressing concern that the elections every 5 years is expensive, particularly when a president dies in office, it becomes too expensive. So instead of using that money to organize such elections, it should be used for developmental or infrastructural development to improve the lives of Zambians. You disagree. Why?
We disagree because this 5-year term in office, both for members of parliament and the president, has worked for us very well as a democracy. We have had no problem over that. The issue of the president dying in office and holding a presidential by-election has been taken care of in the amended constitution that we have now, where we have a running mate who automatically takes over in case the president dies without an election. So there is no longer need to worry about that. What they are scheming now is just their broad agenda to return this country to a one-party state.
Well, some people are saying that your party, the UPND, is opposed to this idea. But when you win power, when Zambians elect you, you will enjoy the same thing. So it has nothing to do with the Patriotic Front Party, but to save Zambia money. Why do you disagree?
We disagree because we think that 5 years is long enough for any political party to implement their manifesto. And extending that beyond 5 years is unreasonable. Because I think right now, when you have a bad leader as a president, 5 years is long enough to destroy a country like we have seen Zambia being destroyed within 5 years of the Patriotic Front rule, where the economy has suddenly nosedived from a growth rate of 7% per annum. Now we're talking about 3%, and it's continuing to decline. Now imagine that you give this person 7 years. What would happen? So we think that 5 years is enough either to take this country forward or even to destroy it. And we don't need to extend the term of office.
Well, I understand this is generating some debate, but how are Zambians taking it? I understand in the strongholds of the Patriotic Front, they have embraced this and they want this to be done. They want a constitutional amendment that will ensure a 7-year term rather than a 5-year term. What has been the general overview reaction from Zambians?
Well, I think many Zambians are still in a state of shock following the general election. The people don't believe that the ruling party won, and that is why even the opposition party leaders have gone to court. So when people are not reacting, they're just angry within themselves, but not expressing themselves openly. And with the suppression of the media now, the voice that is being heard is only the voice through the public media, which are just quoting those commenting in favor of the ruling party.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for the Zambian main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Chadian President Idriss Deby says the multinational joint task force fighting Boko Haram in Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria and Niger is finding it difficult to crush the terrorist. This because they are hiding in communities around the Lake Chad Basin. The Chadian leader who spoke at the end of a visit to Cameroon says it is imperative for the population to help the military by denouncing suspected Boko Haram fighters. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Idriss Deby says the firepower of the Boko Haram terrorist group has been greatly reduced by the multinational joint task force, causing the militant group to resort to cowardly moves such as taking people hostage for ransoms, stealing cattle and food, and deceiving people, especially women and young girls, to carry out suicide missions just to give an impression they are still strong.
Boko Haram aujourd'hui n'est plus Boko Haram des années 2014, est devenu l'ombre de lui-même. Les populations riveraines du lac Tchad.
He says the Boko Haram of today is no longer the Boko Haram of 2014, when it could attack on a large scale. He says it became a shadow of itself when its fighters started hiding as ordinary people in communities to cause havoc, and that he is congratulating people living around Lake Chad for creating self-defense groups to fight the terrorists. But he adds that in order for the group to be completely eradicated, people should denounce suspects in their communities. He says without peace, stability and security, Central African countries will never attain their development objectives. President Deby says the Sambisa forest that straddles Cameroon and the 40 million inhabitants of the Lake Chad area spread across Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Benin are the most vulnerable to Boko Haram atrocities because it has remained the terrorist group's stronghold. He says if the population does not collaborate by reporting suspects, poverty levels will continue to increase as many schools have remained closed and poverty reduction programs will become more difficult to execute. The president says the military has been finding it difficult to organize raids in the area because the terrorists are using civilians as human shields. The United Nations reports that the Boko Haram insurgency in Nigeria and its spillover to neighboring countries have caused the displacement of over 2.7 million people, generating multiple challenges, especially in the Lake Chad Basin. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Three African countries say they are pulling out of the International Criminal Court, or the ICC, but don't prepare for a mass exodus just yet. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig speaks to legal experts who say more countries appear to be serious in their threats to withdraw, but they don't see this as the end for the ICC in Africa.
South Africa and Burundi have sent letters of intent to withdraw from the International Criminal Court to the UN Secretary General, with Gambia saying it will do the same. But these threats have been going on for some time, says Angela Mudukuti, international criminal justice lawyer at the Southern Africa Litigation Center.
And every year around about this time, we see the same thing, where states say they're going to withdraw, but then they never actually do it. Namibia did it last year. Kenya's been talking about it for years. Uganda's spoken about it as well. There are various states that have threatened to leave the ICC but never actually done anything. But now that someone has actually started the process, it is a different ballgame and we could see more.
African leaders have long decried a perceived bias by the court, arguing they are being unfairly targeted. The court has served a warrant for the arrest of Sudan's president Omar al-Bashir, who is wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, and his now deputy, William Ruto, were accused of crimes against humanity connected to 2007 and 2008 post-election violence, although the charges were subsequently withdrawn. All but one of the 10 investigations by the ICC have taken place in African countries.
The critical question comes to your mind, why other atrocities around the world are not brought to the attention of ICC, why the focus is only on Africa. So this is a question which attracts a discussion.
That was John Seka, president of the Tanganyika Law Society in Tanzania. He says that he believes an African court, such as the Arusha-based African Court on Human and People's Rights, would be a better option than the ICC. But Kenyan international law expert and University of Nairobi lecturer Herman Manyora disagrees, saying he does not believe that an African court can supplant the ICC.
For now, no. It can't work. It can't work. Africa is home to impunity. The lords of impunity cannot be expected to come up with a court of justice that can try the very same people who are the perpetrators with impunity.
Manyora argues that more progressive forces are coming into leadership positions, and they don't like the impunity.
You know, they are beginning to take government. Buhari is in Nigeria. There are others elsewhere. And I don't think it's a static situation to say those with the agenda to leave will remain in power. So I don't think Africa will leave en masse. It's not possible.
Tanzania's Seka agrees.
I am not envisioning a dead ICC in the next years. I think it will continue to exist for quite a while, and it will be with us for more time to come.
Mudukuti says that state parties have the power to amend the Rome Statute, so they should instead work to fix the problems, not leave.
And states that have signed up to the Rome Statute have the capacity and the potential to affect change from inside. But once you leave the system, there's nothing you can do about it.
South Africa, Burundi, and Gambia are planning to leave anyway. The question now is, will other African nations follow? Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Thousands of South Sudanese Imatong State residents, including many women and children, are fleeing to Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya. South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission officials in the state capital Torit say the number of refugees has risen in the last few weeks because of concerns that security will sharply deteriorate during the dry season, which is due to begin in about a month. For VOA, Dimilo Silva Ariolio has more from Torit.
Many of those fleeing Imatong State use public transport vehicles to travel to reach Kapoita and cross into Kenya at the Nadapal crossing point. Lena Akot and her five children boarded a van at Turis Omoliha bus park this morning to travel South Sudan-Kenya border. Akot says she is leaving Turis because insecurity in and around the area makes the environment unsuitable for her children's education. Speaking in colloquial Arabic, Akot says she will only return to South Sudan when she knows it is safe.
I'm taking these children so that they can get good education because I do not see any good studies for children with all this chaos. That is why I say it's better I take them so that they will have a good future. I pray that God help my country. I will still return.
Sarah Deng is another mother who has already moved her children out of the country. Deng says she is convinced Kakuma refugee camp is a more secure place to live in and bring up children. Speaking in colloquial Arabic, Deng says she is back in Torit to take her relatives' children to Kenya, where it is safe and they can recover from the trauma of losing loved ones.
I have my three children and my sister's children whose mother died during this crisis, and also my brother's children whose father went missing to date. Nobody knows his whereabouts. So I want to gather them with my children. Since our country is still not safe, it's better people stay where you don't hear bad, terrifying things.
Deng says these days no one can predict what might happen next. She says until the security situation improves in South Sudan, her children will remain in Kakuma refugee camp.
I've taken my children to Kakuma. They are studying there because that place is good. It enables children to study. Unlike here, where life is difficult. There, people are given food and everything, and children do not hear the sound of guns and will concentrate on studies.
John Odongi Simon is the acting director of the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission office in Greater Eastern Equatoria. He says most people fleeing Imotong State are women and children.
The number within the last 2 weeks has already been increased. As you know, during the months of July and August, there was insecurity, ambushes on the road. That one also tend people not to move anyhow. But during the silence of ambushes on the road along Kapeta Torita Road, for the whole months of, let us talk of the months of September up to October now, there's been no any more ambushes on the road. People move freely and they reach calm in Kapeta, from Kapeta to Nadapal. People begin to move in a big number, not only from Torit here, but people also come from Juba.
Odongi says besides fearing insecurity in the state, some residents feel they can no longer cope with the tough economic conditions in South Sudan. Odongi says the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission is not keeping track of the number of people fleeing South Sudan because they are doing so voluntarily. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
The Ethiopian tourism sector is suffering. The impact of a year of violent protest and state of emergency has led to a decline in tourists visiting the country. Ethiopia has been showing signs of becoming a popular new tourism destination in recent years, attracting people not only for its historical sites, but also for its reputation as one of the safest African countries. For VOA, Martha van der Wolf reports from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
Rock churches in the historical town of Lalibela in northern Ethiopia attract thousands of tourists each year. But the six-month state of emergency declared 3 weeks ago by the government to deal with months of protest is scaring away tourists. Belinda Mengesha is a Lalibela tour guide who was born and raised in the town. He says October is usually the start of the high season, but not this year.
Unfortunately, because of this current problems happening in some parts of the country, some tourists has already cancelled their trip to Ethiopia.
Belaina also says tourism is a source of income, directly or indirectly, for many citizens of Lalibela, meaning that any decrease of visitors affects the entire community, even though Lalibela has not been hit by the protests and demonstrations. Oromo and Amhara demonstrators took to the streets to protest the land disputes with the government. Bram van Loonsbroek flies air balloons over the Oromia region and had to cancel several flights after the state of emergency was declared. He says customers are concerned about their safety and want to stay away from areas with unrest.
We don't have anything to do with potential land discussions because we land, we pack the balloon and we are back again. We do give some landing fee to the farmers, and that's what we try to do to comfort the passengers, to explain simply how we work.
Ethiopia has seen the number of tourists steadily increase in the last decade. But any development disturbing the reputation of a tourist destination takes a long time to rebuild. The ongoing protests in Ethiopia resulted in clashes with security forces and hundreds of deaths. Stephen Richer is of Skoll International, a global association promoting tourism. He says because it can be so easy for rumors and misinformation to spread, authorities need to be transparent and clearly communicate the situation so visitors can make good decisions.
So for example, how the Ebola virus was in West Africa and how people stopped going to South Africa because they didn't know the facts. So there's a messaging challenge here, which is start telling people right away what is accurate. Don't sugarcoat it.
Several tour operators say they have about 50% less business than last year, and some actually welcome the state of emergency in the hope that the protests will quickly stop and tourists will return. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Turning to South Africa, acclaimed South African singer-songwriter Ariel Hayes is about to release what she describes as her most challenging album yet. It's called Dream in Music, and its songs are sonically diverse. They vary between harsh computerized electronics and rich acoustic instrumentation. But it is Hayes' powerful voice and lyrics that remain at the forefront. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports in the first part of a series of unique music currently being produced by South African artists.
Mist, it fills my mind whenever I search, I never find.
From the very start, with the ominous blues of the track Child Atone, there's a dark, disturbing, and even hopeless current electrifying Oriel Hayes' new record. Dream in Music swirls with imagery of black clouds and howling winds, dreams destroyed, sinners, unfaithful lovers, and above all, the singer's inner demons. Hayes says these are the most personal songs she's recorded so far.
The most notable for me being Song for Mark, which I wrote for my best friend.
You told me to never give up, give in, to never wallow too long in my sins.
It was the last song I wrote as I was getting divorced. Literally, this man would tell me every day, you know what, Oriel, it's going to be okay. Don't worry. You know, one day you'll look back and this won't be there. The love of friends and family carried me through this and the sanctuary that they gave me.
Hayes calls Dream in Music her sanctuary album, the writing and production of it sheltering her from the trauma of divorce. She says her songs come from very sore places, as she puts it.
One song that generally gets people very emotional when I sing it is In My Lover's Bed. I get offered whiskey and cigarettes after I sing that song.
I drank my whiskey and I light my cigarette and I...
I know what it feels like to be trapped. I know what it feels like to feel as though you are not in control of your own life.
But Hayes doesn't write only about her pain. Dream in Music is packed with reflections on the tragedies of friends, nervous breakdowns, attempted suicides, events the artist says force her to doubt whether life is really worth it. The album is especially influenced by the recent death of one of Hayes's close friends and collaborators.
And then I was inconsolable and I just couldn't stop crying, and I cried for different reasons. I cried because this was someone that believed so intently in music and the ability for music to shift people. And he was ambitious and he wanted to do all of these things, but his number was up.
There's an eclectic mix of instruments on the recording, from xylophones to ukuleles, synthesizers and computers. Hayes says she wanted this record to be full of different sounds, and it is, being almost bombastic at times. The song Different Kinds of Love, featuring vocalist Josie Field, is a good example of the lush magnificence of the album.
That was very much written and inspired again by the idea that my life is filled with so many different people.
And also, again, inspired by pain, this time that of a friend dying of an incurable disease.
This is the same person that is now in a shelter so far away from me, where I can do nothing, who has a few days left to live. And I said, this is for him.
Hayes says writing this record has shown her a path to the future.
I have a very clear vision of who it is that I am, the people that I love, what I stand for and how I want to make a difference in this world. And the best way that I can do it, aside from loving people and being as honest as I can about that, is with music.
Let's dream in music.
Dream in Music is an oral assault that's so visceral that often it seems as if actual blood and bone are the instruments used to create sound, to reveal music that's broken yet beautiful. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We begin with the African Confederation Cup, where TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo took a big step towards winning the cup after drawing 1-1 at Mamelodi Bejaia of Algeria in the first leg of the final on Saturday. The second leg is next Sunday in the Congolese mining city of Lubumbashi, and a goalless draw will be enough to give Mazembe the trophy for the first time after finishing runners-up 3 seasons ago. This year's Confederation Cup winners will both receive $660,000 in prize money, with $462,000 going to the runners-up, and take on Champions League winners Mamelodi Sundowns in the annual CAF Super Cup. In athletics, Marco Corrier won the three-way Kenyan contest and took the 35th edition of the Frankfurt Marathon with a time of 2 hours, 6 minutes and 48 seconds. The 28-year-old beat fellow Kenyans Martin Kosgei and Sebrian Kotut. Bobby Curtis of the U.S. took a surprising fourth place with 2 hours, 11 and 20 seconds in very good weather conditions. In the women's race, Mami Tudaska took Frankfurt for the second time after winning in 2011. The 33-year-old Ethiopian is said to have suffered stomach problems earlier, but finished in 2 hours, 25 minutes and 27 seconds. German's Ethiopian-born Fateh Tola made up more than 2 minutes on the leader in the last few kilometers, but could not quite reach her. Tola finished second, while Kenya's Sarah Jabet came in third. Lindsay Flanagan of the U.S. surprised with the fourth place. For VOA, the energetic Andy Edwards talked to Mark Correa, the winner of Sunday's marathon.
Mark Correa has achieved another fine win in his career. He's won the Minova Frankfurt Marathon title 2016. He's just had to go off and answer a call of nature in the bathroom, and before he did, he also looked to be struggling with a bit of cramp, but he crossed the finish line in style, 2:06:48. Mark, you really took control of that race of 35 kilometres. It's the classic way to win a marathon. Is that how it felt for you?
I can say today's race was really fantastic for me. You know, the pacemakers did their job well. And when the pacemakers finished, we decided we remained three guys. Then we pushed until 35 kilometers. Then I see it was too slow. Then I decided now to push at 38 kilometers. Then I see my guys are not coming again. Then I started to push until the end.
And it was an all-Kenyan trio, as often in races, in marathons. Cyprian Kotut, younger brother of Martinelli, he was third. And then Martin Koskai, who sprang a surprise to finish second. You were the most experienced man of the three. Do you think that counts for a lot? You won the Paris Marathon last year, and you've been around. You know what the top-class marathons are like.
I think this is my fifth marathon running in my career, and I think now I have gained some more experience. Last year I did Paris, and Paris was my biggest victory. So, and this again, I did again here in Frankfurt.
And Edward speaking with Mark Correa, who just won the Frankfurt Marathon. Meanwhile, South Africa's Stephen Makoka emerged victorious from a three-man battle to take his third title in 4 years at the Shanghai International Marathon on Sunday. Enjoying a solitary lead in the last 7 kilometers, the 31-year-old Makoka clocked 2 hours, 10 minutes and 18 seconds to take a commanding victory. Makoka is the second man to collect 3 wins in the race's 21-year history. Ethiopia's Geshau Asfar also achieved the feat with 3 victories in a row from 2008 to 2010. Kenya's Asbel Kipsang and Ethiopia's Abdi Fufa came second and third, respectively. In the women's race, Rosa Dereje of Ethiopia held off a strong challenge from Kenya's Margaret Agai in the last 100 meters to take the title with a career best. Still in athletics, the Association of International Marathons and Distance Races, AIMS, named Eliud Kipchoge and Jamina Samgong the male and female winners of the AIMS Best Marathon Run Award for 2016. The achievements over the past year will be recognized at the 4th annual AIMS Best Marathon Run Awards dinner reception in Athens, in Greece, on November 11th this year. This is the second consecutive year that 31-year-old Kipchoge will receive the award. In April, he won the London Marathon for the second straight time, setting a course record of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 5 seconds. He then followed up by winning his first and Kenya's second Olympic gold medal in the marathon. Samgong also enjoyed an impressive year. Despite falling, she recovered to win the London Marathon in April. She then traveled to Rio, where she captured Kenya's first gold medal in the women's marathon. The awards reception will also see distance running legend Haile Gebrselassie recognized with the AIMS Lifetime Achievement Award. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
making me mad. Cause the way you pull it down, make me want to go mad. Oh my God, girl, the way you grind. Anytime I see you, I'm blind. The way you handle that. Uku!
mix monster, mix monster.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It will not be surprising if many Africans are not familiar with the functioning of the Human Rights Commission, which is located in Geneva. The Human Rights Commission is a subsidiary organ of the General Assembly, and it supervises human rights performance and violations throughout the world. Its predecessor was the Human Rights Commission, which was also involved with observing the performance of countries in human rights, and actually arose from the fact that during the Second World War, there was a violation of human rights, including the Holocaust, and the Human Rights Commission was set up to see how to prevent such outcomes in the future. But the Human Rights Commission was criticized over the years as being biased against certain countries, and that the membership was not sufficient for the observation of human rights. So in 2006, as part of the reform of the United Nations, the Human Rights Council was formed. It has 47 members, and it is rotating on a regular basis one-third of its membership. The voting pattern was made such to show that only members who are observing basic human rights could be considered. Of course, this has not developed to be the case because elections in the UN, as in many of its organs, is based on regional basis. And the regional groups make decision on who should be their candidates. This year, last Friday, the General Assembly voted on 14 new members. Usually it is a routine, but not this year, because non-governmental organizations, NGOs, combined this year to oppose certain candidatures. 80 of them combined to oppose the election of Russia to the council. Russia was accused of violation of human rights in its bombing campaign in Syria, particularly in Aleppo. There were others who believed that Saudi Arabia should not also be in the council, primarily because of its own bombing campaign in Yemen. Over the years, people have questioned whether Cuba should be a member of the commission, of the council. So when the vote was taken on Friday, Russia failed to gain a seat in the council. Russia was part of a three-states competition for Eastern Europe, which was two seats. Hungary went through quickly, and Russia was locked in a competition with Croatia. In the end, Croatia edged out Russia, gaining 114 votes to Russia's 112 votes. Saudi Arabia won re-election with 154 votes. Interestingly, Russia was not bitter about its failure to gain membership in the council. The ambassador of Russia said that Russia realizes it was in a difficult group and planned to campaign next year for a seat in the council. This is very important because as a permanent member, Russia could adversely affect the work of the council if it feels very bitter. Africa re-elected three members, Rwanda, Egypt, and Tunisia. And this Human Rights Council is quite different from the International Criminal Court. Whereas the Criminal Court has been accused of focusing primarily on Africa, the Human Rights Council is more global. It criticizes countries far and wide. And this is how the United Nations should behave. And you will hear from time to time investigation of Human Rights Council's officials to Africa. You should now know how it functions and how its members are selected. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Kaseas Martin, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, choose your neighbors before you buy your house. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Trafficking in persons, also known as human trafficking or modern-day slavery, is a crime involving the exploitation of someone for the purposes of compelled labor or a commercial sex act through the use of force, fraud, or coercion. Human trafficking is a global problem, and no country is immune, not even the United States. The notion of modern-day slavery is one that touches everybody's conscience, and it is one of fundamental basic human decency, said Secretary of State John Kerry. The fight against human trafficking is about far more than merely doing the right thing, he said. Trafficking in persons is an assault on human rights, and it's a threat to global stability. It undermines the rule of law, it breeds corruption, it spreads disease, it widens the gap between the haves and the have-nots, and it tears whole families apart. So it's counter to every single thing that we're trying to accomplish in the field of development and everything that we would like to see in our communities and in communities elsewhere in the world as we try to live up to the 2030 development goals. Following President Obama's March 2012 call to strengthen federal efforts to combat human trafficking, the President's Interagency Task Force to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons has convened leaders from government, the private sector, advocates, survivors, communities of faith, civil society, law enforcement, and academia to implement a coordinated agenda that prevents trafficking, protects victims, and prosecutes offenders. There is nothing inevitable about trafficking in human beings. That conviction is where the process of change really begins, with the realization that just because a certain abuse has taken place in the past doesn't mean that we have to tolerate that abuse in the future or that we can afford to avert our eyes, wrote Secretary of State Kerry in the introduction to this year's Trafficking in Persons report, which was issued in June. Ending modern slavery isn't just a fight we should attempt. It is a fight we can and must win. While more work is required to tackle the root causes and consequences of human trafficking, the United States continues to be a leader in the global movement to end modern-day slavery. By working together, sharing information, and partnering with a broad range of organizations, the U.S. government continues to explore new and innovative approaches to end the plight of trafficking victims.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.